to our first meeting of the day. I think we will probably be fairly short. We'd scheduled this when I anticipated a knockdown dragout on House Bill 2474 this afternoon, but Mr. Chandler informs me that the parties have all come together and they're going to tell us all about that when we get to that point. So that should substantially shorten the time for this meeting. We will be reconvening at 3 o'clock. Is that in this room?
Yes, sir.
With the Senate. Just on that, before we get started here, you'll have a packet of information to help you. If we get done early, you can spend some time looking at some amendments to House Bill 2525 that will be coming up. With the amendments is a letter from David Hendricks that outlines the amendments for you, and also a letter from Chip Lazenby that is of interest. It confirms the governor's agreement to the bill with the amendments that are before you. So that'll sort of set the stage for this afternoon's hearing on 2525. Let's begin today with a work session on House Bill 3576. Council, refresh us.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as you will remember, House Bill 3576 exempts from public disclosure information that would adversely affect the public sale or purchase of electric power. When we last met, there was some discussion as to which section of the statutes this ought to be in terms of the public records law. The public utility folks are advocating that it be a complete exemption, and the newspaper publishers were suggesting perhaps it go in the adjoining ORS, which allows a less complete exemption. I understand there's also a dash one amendment being put forth by the public utility people.
And I see a dash two as well.
My understanding is that they're just advocating the dash one.
Is that right? Okay. Who's here that would like to tell us about the dash one amendments? Tom, Diane?
Do you not have those?
We're in work session, but I'll ask them to come up
and
explain them to us.
For the record, I'm Diane Cowan, representing the Oregon PUD Association. The dash one amendments narrow greatly. Sub 25 on page 4, line 12. In the bill, it stated information that it disclosed would adversely affect a public body's purchase. A public body is being changed to the word the, so it would be it would adversely affect the purchase or sale of electric power or services, and then add the language by a people's utility district or municipally owned electric utility. A public body would have encompassed much more than our intent.
Okay, so if we're hand engrossing that again on line 12, information that if disclosed would adversely affect the purchase or sale of electric power or services by a people's utility district or municipally owned electric utility.
That's correct.
Yes, sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about that because it's really what we're talking about is proprietary information, business information. And it seems my recollection there's already a statute that may protect that. I've been looking for it, but I can't find it. It probably because my mind is not running the same groove as whoever makes our index in the statute book, which doesn't surprise me. But are you familiar with that statute and what its relationship perhaps to what's on line 25?
Mr. Chair, Representative Werbelow, with the caveat that especially in this committee, I better offer that I am not an attorney. I know that there is language about proprietary exceptions for proprietary information of private entities when they're in contract with a public body. My recollection is that's been pretty limited to what constitutes proprietary information is pretty limited. It would not be enough, I don't think, in our case to cover the kinds of contracts and contract language that we would be entering into with individual businesses or other suppliers, whereas our the private utilities and the co-ops would have would not have to disclose any of that information, whether it was proprietary or not.
Yes.
Actually, Mr. Chair, with the help of our learned counsel here, I now find the statute 192.501. And it does talk about, I'm not sure if it's covered or not, so
okay.
We'll go on.
Let me ask, where do the dash twos come from? Not that I'm planning on anything.
Could you tell me what they are?
Oh, it deletes lines 12 and 13 on page 4 of the bill.
Which line? I think those are in error, Mr. Chair.
Oh, is that right?
Okay.
Yeah. Sure you'd say that.
I don't have them.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
My assent determines they're from...
Yeah,
okay.
That was...
But yeah, nothing you're advancing, obviously.
No.
Okay, just wanted to make sure. Yes, Representative Edwards.
Kind of a technical question about how this would work. Adopting this law, who would oversee the empowering of this law? Is it, obviously you're not under the PUC, so who's going to enforce this law as it's written? If there's a violation, you're saying you want certain things exempt from public record, and yet if somebody tries to get that information or obtains it some way, is there an enforcement mechanism, and if so, how?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, in that sort of that instance, if people thought we were violating the provisions of the statute, their recourse is to go to the court and ask for clarification, as with any other exemption.
Or just Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, or the district attorney has been asked to render an opinion in some of these situations.
I think that's the case. If someone asks for information and the public body takes the position that it's not subject to disclosure and there's a dispute as to whether it is or is not, I do believe that there's recourse to the DA's office and the counties to get that resolved, and then from there it goes to court for review of the DA's determination.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, and in fact in response to Representative Edwards' question, one of the reasons we're here is that in several years ago in Coos County, there was a situation where a business requested information about the exact rates and electric usage of all the other businesses in town, and the city questioned whether that was appropriate without the consent of the other businesses and residents, and it went to the district attorney, and the district attorney said that in Coos County said there was no protections in the Public Records Act and that they had to turn over those records. And that's one of the reasons we're here today.
One final thing. How does this bill fit with what may become law in power deregulation? Is there a similar language in that bill, one, and two? Wouldn't there be in a competition, assuming, let's say I know you've got a position on whether or not we allow you in or out of competition. Let's just say your board decides, a board decides that they want to have competition within your territory. Does this law preclude then from customer lists being available to somebody who wants to compete in your territory? Does this exemption come off so that there can be competition?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, there is no utility that has a requirement under any circumstances, competition or otherwise, to release the names and personally identifiable information about customers to any competitor. The two reasons that we put this forward, the contractual language in the first part, primarily because of the changes that have occurred in the wholesale market, and two, the fact that we have discovered deregulation or no deregulation, that what we thought we had, that our customers had the privacy of the information that they submitted to us, that it would not be released unless they authorized it to be released. We found that our assumption in that case was not true, and that we would have to release personally identifiable information about customers. Hence the reason that we're here. And although we do have language similar, yes, in the deregulation bill, and we're not sure what's going to happen with that, And we believe that these are issues that are separate and above from whether you deregulate or not. It's the issues that we're facing right now.
Sure.
Just although the issue came to forefront once the wholesale market was opened up.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, in the case of the customer list, the issue came up in 1995, the specific instance.
You're talking about the Coos Bay inquiry? Yeah. All right. Lori Bacher, do you want to come up and say anything on this with the Dash 1 amendments? Okay. You're still a big no on the bill.
And members of the committee, but for the record, Lori Bracker, Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association, General Counsel. And we just have the same two concerns, Mr. Chair, and Representative Edwards, one that you raised, that the language is very similar. In fact, 1149 actually is a little more specific and definitive in its language. So in talking to the proponents about what will happen if both of these pass and whether legislative council will pick or choose, or that question is out there from our perspective. And secondarily, we do still raise the issue of putting it into 501, so in that rare instance where it may be a legitimate request, the public interest is considered by the district attorney or in a state level attorney general.
Yeah, as far as the DREG bill, I guess at some point when one of these passes and the other one is still moving through the process, there would be conforming amendments that would pull the two together. I'll see a watch for that. But that doesn't address your second point. Anybody else on this? Were you going to speak?
No.
You looked like you were.
Well, I'm eating my mints. This whole area is somewhat troubling. It seems to me, Mr. Chairman, that as we treat these issues, typically we ought to try to be consistent in the approach that we take. I guess I would. I would favor that as we approach these things, we put them in that balancing category. Typically, I mean, that would be the default for me on these issues, Mr. Chair.
So the issue being 192.502 or 192.501. Okay. Happy to have some further discussion about that, Representative Werbelow.
Yes, I was just going to say, I start from the premise that I favor openness, and I think that's what we should pursue. However, I realize that with deregulation looming, that it creates some real issues between private entities and public entities. And so you have to take that in consideration. I would have liked to have had, and it's really, I can only fault myself because I did not think about this before, but I would have liked to have had some input from counsel to see if proprietary documentation was covered under the existing law, or do we have to have this here. Also, probably because I love balance, the concept of balancing, I would rather have it in 501 instead of 502. However, I will not let those concerns, because in my mind right now they don't rise to the level of voting against this. I will vote the bill out of committee. We'll do some further looking at this, and if appropriate, perhaps talk to people on the Senate side.
Committee, I guess my preference, being where we are at this point in the session, would be to go ahead and move the bill out as is. I fully expect, based on the experience we've had over in the Senate already this session, that the Senate committee will amend this into 501. And if they do that, I'm prepared to recommend concurrence. It's not that big an issue for me, but we have the bill before us in 502. And rather than send it back for that amendment, when I expect that's going to happen anyway on the Senate side, it's not one of these where I'm expecting the Senate to fix an error. I don't think I wouldn't lose any sleep if it stayed in 502, but by the same token, I expect that they will move it into 501, and if they do, I'm perfectly comfortable with that, too. Representative Edwards.
The only thing, too, looking at kind of the other parts of the statute, they're pretty specific about what it is that you're exempting, things like payment requests, certifications, things that are very specific. This is just information that if, I mean, it's judgmental, and I'm willing to move the bill. I guess we could tighten that as well, I think, at some point. even though it doesn't say specifically customer lists or I mean, it says information that a PUC or municipally owned electric utility has about a customer. I'm not quite sure what that all entails, whether it's pricing, contracts, I don't, could be a whole host of things. Maybe they have a comment about that, but when you look at the other parts of the statute, it's pretty specific, it's pinpoint, so.
Did you want to comment on that? Customer, I assume, is your retail customer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that would also include social security numbers, unlisted phone numbers, personal information about the customer, yep. In addition.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, the language that I actually, that we actually put in front of Legislative Council, I think said personally identifiable information about, and in fact, we took it out of language that's in the your cable TV customer bill of rights about that that information is private unless you deem it to be, unless you authorize it to be released. Legislative Council drafted it the way you see it, but that's what we submitted, and our intent was that it was personally identifiable information about customers. The other section was based on the Oregon Health, the existing exemption provided to the Oregon Health Sciences University that was put in place 2 sessions ago, I believe.
Mr. Chair, to speak to that also, Representative Edwards, the language we took to Legislative Council, we took that twice, and he was quite comfortable that this language was doing the same thing that we had offered.
Thank you.
Anybody else on this? Okay, we're in work session. Chair, I entertain a motion to move the dash one amendments.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Williams.
With the reservations that I stated, I will move the dash one amendments.
I appreciate that. Representative Williams moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 3576. Is there any objection? Any discussion? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Williams.
I'll move House Bill 3576 to the floor with a due pass as amended.
Representative Williams moves House Bill 3576 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Not, please call the roll.
Representative Backman?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Aye.
Representative Lowe?
Aye.
Representative Nicolau?
Yes.
Representative Walker?
Aye.
Moving the vote.
Yes.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Excused.
Chair Federley?
Aye. House Bill 3576 as amended goes to the floor with a new pass. Anybody want to carry this?
It's your bill.
It's my bill, yeah. Anybody want to carry it? Okay, I'll do it. Pardon? Oh, you want it?
Sure.
Representative Edwards got it. Sure. I'm happy to share.
You have reservations down. It's kind of a blame.
I won't raise those on
We're training you to be a lawyer, Randall.
Okay, the next bill comes to us on... Is this on loan, or are we passing this to the floor from here?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think we're awaiting some dash two amendments, so perhaps we can
on
take
3526?
I thought you were talking about 2474.
3526 comes to us from
referred to us.
Human resources. Yeah.
I think that's kind of funny.
Where have it been loaned, as the term is known?
Work session for the transfer in the building house. I guess it's ours, so it's going to be up to us now. I'll open the public, I'm sorry, the work session on House Bill 3526. Who is here that can speak on House Bill 3526? Come on forward.
Perhaps you can ask him why it came to us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston. I represent the Oregon State Firefighters Council. Just a little bit of background about this bill and a bill that's currently tonight at 6:30 will be voted on in the House, Senate Bill 846. Early on and in the process, I was talking to Brian DeLasmid, who represents the police officers. They had a very similar bill, unbeknownst to me and the rest of the firefighters. We got together, and just by happenstance, 846 actually has had some movement in the process. It's the same bill. There's been some amendments to it. We've worked with most of the groups that have issues with it, and I foresee that Senate Bill 846 within the next 3 or 4 days is probably going to be coming to this committee. It will do the same thing that 3526 does, and leave it up to the chair to, if it would be not too much bothersome, if maybe we just kind of held this one in place and actually use that one as it comes over or whatever.
Sounds good to me. I don't need to spend any time on the bill that we don't need to spend time on. So, yeah, that's good. I appreciate the update on that. What's the number of the Senate bill?
Senate Bill 846, and I do believe they have a session tonight, and it's about 3 or 4 on the list of carryovers. It's been carried over for about 4 or 5 days, and it passed out of Judiciary in the Senate on a unanimous deal. I don't think there's a lot of controversy with this bill.
Sounds good.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Werbelow.
Was the purpose of sending it here from Human Services to give it a place to life so we see what happens with the Senate bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Werbelow, I believe the reason that it came here had to do with some of the legal aspects of this bill in regards to confidentiality and some of the issues that were involved in that. In my discussions that I had with Human Resources, they felt that because of those legal issues, it was a better fit for this committee.
Dealing with confidential and privileged communications,
okay.
I suppose.
Yes.
Representative?
So, Mr. Chair, as I understand it, so you're saying a Senate bill which it may come to this committee first, or is it going to go first down to wherever this bill came from, Human Resources?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I believe I'm not the one that tells where the bills go, but I'm guessing that
coming out of Judiciary on the Senate side, it'll probably come here.
Yeah, I'm speculating on that, and I believe that this probably would be the appropriate mechanism to initially hear that particular bill would be for this committee to deal with that, since your counterpart in the Senate has heard it and would be able to deal with some of the concerns that this committee may have in regards to confidentiality and whatnot.
Mr. Chair, just follow up on that. Then I would suggest that we request the bill to come here. Thanks.
That's why I wanted to ask for sure what the bill number was. I'll send a request down to Mr. Wilson in the Speaker's office and see if we can get that over here.
And we would also appreciate that as well, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. I guess that takes care of this, and thanks, Mr. Livingston. We will close the work session on House Bill 3526 and go to House Bill 3397. Council?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as you will remember, House Bill 3397 received a hearing here previously, and it exempts from public disclosure records of employee addresses submitted to a special district to obtain assistance in promoting an alternative to single-occupant motor vehicle transportation. At that hearing, we heard from representatives of TriMet, who discussed some of the programs they have to encourage carpools and other alternatives to single vehicle transport, and their needs for confidentiality and sharing information about their ridership and other sorts of information. And I see that the representative from TriMet is here today. Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Bottomley? Yeah. Come on up. We talked about this briefly, but give it to us one more time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bernie Bottomley from TriMet. The issue here is that we work with companies in the metro area to help them fulfill the requirements of the ECO rule, which requires businesses to reduce the number of single-occupant vehicles traveling to their workplace. As part of that program, we offer a service to the businesses free of charge that they give us their list of employees, including their home addresses. We then enter those in a computer, and they're mapped so that the employers can see where there are clusters of employees, and then work with them to set up carpool and vanpool type arrangements. And the difficulty comes that when the company gives us the list of their employees, it is then becomes part of the public record law. And we have had requests for those lists from the media. We haven't had an instance where we actually had the list in our possession at the time when the request came in. We process the list, and then we return it to the business when we're done with it.
Okay. Lori Brocker, I'm sorry to interrupt. You missed the first hearing on this. Do you want to speak on this bill?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, as I indicated to you by email, Mr. Chair, we had a concern similar to the other concerns that we've raised, and that is the issue of putting it in 192.502 and not 192.501. There's a real commitment on the part of the newspaper publishers, of whom I represent, that we at least, for almost all of these, that we at least have the opportunity for the public interest to be considered in that hopefully rare instance where there's an issue that could be raised that legitimately is something that the public should be aware of.
I guess, you know, having heard the first bill in the context of this one now, this is one where, as I understand, this isn't TriMet's information to begin with. That's right. This is information that happens to fall into your possession for a how long? A couple of weeks? How long?
Usually a couple of weeks to process the material, and then we return it.
It's borrowed information, I guess.
Yeah. They loan it to us.
Right.
That's what it amounts to, yeah.
Representative Warbelow?
I would just thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to make the same observation. This is private information that for the purpose of promoting or finding ways to get us to change our behavior as far as how we ride and so forth, and we borrow that to see how the public entity can assist in that matter. And this seems to be a whole different scenario or ball of wax, whatever you want to call it, than what we're talking about with a public utility, where you start with public utility information. And I guess I'm just curious why the newspaper would think that this should ever be information they should have access, because it is private information, just on loan, and they wouldn't have access to it from the private entity unless they wanted to release it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Uberlau, two separate responses to that. First, one thing that I didn't state initially, and Mr. Bottomley and I talked about this before, is that we do have a belief that one of the other provisions that's already in there could arguably cover this information, and that is in sub 4. I don't know if that's before you. It talks about information that is otherwise intended to be confidential. And one of the issues then for folks who are proponents of these kind of exemptions is there isn't a lot of case law out there that defines whether this actually falls under it. So the specific exemption gives them a little more comfort, I think. But we would argue that it's already covered if it clearly is exactly what you're talking about, Representative, and that is information that was intended to be private and solely private and has no arguably public aspect to it otherwise. The problem for the newspaper publishers in all of these exemptions, and this session we've had a large number, Mr. Chair is rolling his eyes, so I'm not just stating that just because of my own bias. The concern is that the absolute exemption of 502 was intended to really cover only those things that are very clearly of absolute, I mean, where they just really have no business being in the public realm. For example, and I'm not saying that we would indicate that those exemptions that are currently in there satisfy that test. But nonetheless, that's the premise of when the public records law came about in the 70s. And what has happened over time is that has kind of been broadened because, you know, understandably so, persons who want exemptions want clarity about it's always going to be exempt and we don't have to play any game with the district attorney or the attorney general in arguing this or in some administrative sort of back and forth kind of quasi-litigation kind of aspect. So the newspaper publishers still philosophically go with what they've gone with for the past 2.5 decades, and that is that almost invariably every exemption that comes before the legislature should be in, if it's going to be in anything at all, should be in 501 to allow for the public's interest, albeit that very rare instance, even when it may have originated as private information, there is that balancing test that comes into play. Because at some given point, and again, it may be a very temporary point, it is part of the public realm and part of the benefits that the either locality or the state gives to its people. So, I mean, that's a, probably a nebulous philosophical answer, but nonetheless, that's the premise of their position.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But maybe just as nebulous, but I don't think so. Should we not give some value to the expectation of the person who this information is about? For example, if I worked with Joe's Garage, I wouldn't have any expectation that Joe's Garage is going to let out information about me, because I know that's a private record, it's not a public record. And yet, just because I am environmentally oriented, I'd like to be able to find out how I can hook up with carpools or whatever. And so for that limited purpose, but then to keep extending it further, I think we are forgetting the people this information is about, and that has to be part of the equation as we look at these types of bills.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Ubelard, I agree with you completely, except I would just come at it from a different place. I would say that Joe's Garage is more of a private entity than we're talking about when we talk about public transportation. But separate from that, the balancing test precisely would take into consideration exactly what you're talking about. It would allow for someone to come back, and that's exactly what often happens, where someone says, this is intended to be private information, I'm sorry, your request is denied, and that is consistently what happens. The concern that we have is that the absolute exemption doesn't allow for that very rare instance when there might be some legitimate need, or whether it, for instance, perhaps some statistical information, not where it gives out private names or anything like that, but statistical information about who's using what, when, here, where, and how in public transportation arenas. So that may, by a district attorney or attorney general who is perusing this request, may be deemed as to be of public interest, and then what often happens is that any kind of quote-unquote very personal private information like names, addresses, and whatever are not allowed to be disclosed.
Thanks for the comment. Thank you. Mr. Chair, actually, as that private person, I don't think I'd want to be subjected to a balancing test. And my final comment is that I think it could discourage a public good, and the public good is to have people do carpools or ride vans or whatever. But I think if most private people, if they thought having information about them be temporarily loaned to somebody in order to put these people together, they would say no if they thought that information might become private in the way you're talking about. That's just kind of my thought about that.
And didn't we have testimony at the first hearing on this that, in fact, there had been a request made, was it, to get information about Intel employees, yeah.
Yes, Chair Shetterly, we did have a request that came in from the Oregonian, from a reporter from the Oregonian, for the list of employees' home addresses for the employees of Intel. And the story was about the commute patterns of Intel employees. And fortunately, the list was not then in our possession, although it had been in our possession a few weeks earlier. And so that's where this issue comes from, was that very case where our legal staff was alerted to the possibility that kind of request would come in, and they looked at the statute and at the case law and were not comfortable that we would be able to give the companies a pretty solid guarantee that their employee information would not be released. And so we put a disclaimer on the material that we have the companies sign when they give us the list, and we explain to them that this list is not a rock-solid, secure thing when it goes to TriMet, and we've had about a third of the companies decline to participate because of that. Just one other thought on that to get to Representative Urbelow's point was that the language says the addresses. So if it came to statistical information or other information that didn't deal with the specific home address of the person, those would not be covered by this. It would just be the addresses.
Okay, well, I think we've talked this one through. Are we ready for a motion?
Okay. I'll move.
Representative Orbelow.
I'll move for the due pass recommendation.
Moves House Bill 3397. Let's see, we don't have any amendments, so that's unamended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Wells.
Maybe I was out in the hall, but we were talking about consistency a while ago. I think we really do have consistency. In my time being in the legislature, I always kind of felt sorry for the newspaper people when they come and lobby, because I think consistently we have voted against them on every time they've come and talked about enacting these types of statutes. Yeah. I can never remember a case when we haven't.
Yeah. Well, and this is one again, too. I think between the two that we've heard today, I think this has a better case for being in Section 502, although, again, if the Senate Judiciary wants to work its magic and move it into Senate 501, I certainly would concur and not put this into conference about that either. So we'll see what they do. Please call the roll.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Aye.
Representative Walz?
Aye.
Representative Verbalow?
Yes.
Representative Walker?
Yes.
Representative Wells?
Yes.
Representative Williams?
Yes.
Chair Shetterly?
Yes. House Bill 2474, 3397, I'm already going to the next one. Passed. You worry, didn't I? Passes to the...
Tabled indefinitely, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Who'd like to carry this one? Representative Backlund, thank you. Mr. Chandler, is the choir assembled? All right.
All the suits are here.
In that case, then, we'll go into work session on House Bill 2474. Council?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as the -2 amendments are being handed out, House Bill 2474, which is, in fact, on loan to us from the Committee on General Government, allows a person developing real property to challenge the conditions of approval imposed by local government as a condemnation claim under the Oregon and United States constitutions. I've not had a chance to look at the -2s, and I defer to Mr. Chandler to explain them to the committee.
Okay. And this is one where we have a little time. I just assume, since this has been loaned to us, give it a decent once-over so we know what we're giving our stamp of approval to. But come on up. Mr. Chandler, who else do you want to have with you?
Well, we've got the chorus assembled.
Bring them on up.
Yeah.
Look at that. Here, we got more room on down on this end. If you
want to sit on Chandler.
A lot of that going around. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Building Industry Association, here on House Bill 2474. Too bad the media isn't here, because it's a fairly interesting table
that
has assembled. If you don't mind, let me walk through what the bill does.
Yes.
The printed bill should be ignored and used to wrap fish with. The -2 amendments are the product of a series of meetings between us and local governments and Oregon in Action to hammer out the solution to the problem. The problem is that under current law, a developer who goes in for a development approval oftentimes has approval conditions attached to that application. Currently, that developer, if a condition is one that they don't believe is warranted, either constitutionally or because it violates the local government's code and regulations, has two choices. They can accept the condition and do whatever it is, even though they don't believe it's appropriate, or they can reject the condition and go to LUBA on an appeal, the Land Use Board of Appeals, to try to get the condition removed. But in the meantime, the development project stops and does not go forward. Oftentimes, from a developer standpoint, that means a great deal of money in terms of the loan. The option can't be completed. The property can't be obtained. And as a result, from our standpoint, conditions get agreed to that perhaps should not be. What this bill is attempting, without trying to determine what conditions are or are not valid, is an attempt to address that situation. In the -2 amendment, Section 2, Sub 1, what that says in fewer words is that an applicant can accept a condition essentially under protest. They can comply with the condition we provided here that they would have to pay the fee if there was one involved. They would have to perform the act if it was like setting aside, building a street, putting in a stoplight, putting in a pond, whatever it might be, or post a bond or some other satisfactory performance guarantee, so that the local government was held harmless from the not having the condition done. But they could accept that condition and then go forward with the project and take an appeal of the condition either to the Land Use Board of Appeals. I'm now in section sub 2. To the Land Use Board of Appeals if it was simply to try to get rid of an imposed condition, or to the Court of Appeals if the project in question was an expedited land division, that's the reference in line 21, or to the Circuit Court if it was an action for money damages or an inverse condemnation. In other words, if the applicant was seeking to get money from the local government because of to be paid back for performing the condition of approval, they'd have to go to Circuit Court. LUBA does not have the authority to award damages. That's section 2 looks more complicated than it actually is.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, let's start this.
Yes,
Chan,
go ahead.
Question. Mr. Chandler, is one of these ways to proceed exclusive, or can they proceed through all three?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that. They're exclusive. The reason we worded section 2 sub A, appeal the decision to impose a condition to LUBA pursuant to ORS 197805, etc. Those are the jurisdictional statutes for LUBA which confer exclusive jurisdiction on for land use matters to LUBA.
Okay, then, excuse me, I guess I didn't make my question clear enough. You are going to different bodies for different reasons. I understand that. Okay. But could they do all three? If all three conditions were satisfied, for example, they could go into the Circuit Court for damages, they could go into the Court of Appeals for the 197-375 issue, and into the board. Could they have three cases going at once?
No. No.
The avenue of recourse is going to be driven by what relief they're seeking, is that it?
Precisely, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
And furthermore, the expedited sub B, relating to expedited land divisions, that's a separate critter that has its own appellate structure. So there could be a case where you went to LUBA. Well, no, you're assuming they're going separately. You could go to LUBA and prevail and come back on an inverse action in Circuit Court subsequent in an inverse condemnation, but you would not be doing both at once.
Okay.
Is one of the maybe the drafting clarification on line 19 at the end, if that semicolon should have an or?
I think the drafting manual that they have at LC says that if you've got a series of semicolons at the end of which is either an or an and, while all the preceding ones are the same, it's either they're all conjunctive or they're all disjunctive.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. I've lost that argument several times with this counsel. Stylistically, I agree with Representative Edwards, but they don't seem to care.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a good, you know, we see that. Representative Wells has a question.
Thank you. John, when you accept the condition and then you move ahead, how do you make that decision whether to, when you're developing then, to, you're going to go ahead and do it the way you want to and then go back and change it if you lose the case? Or how do you make that decision of how you move ahead if knowing that that condition is there? Work around it? Is that in practicality, how would that work? Say, for instance, has to do with a street or has something, how do you work around that condition? You let everybody make their own decision how well they can do it and how they move ahead?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wells, it would be on a case-by-case basis, but to use the example you gave, the condition is to widen the street. The way the bill is written, you have a fairly short time period in which to challenge these. And so the local government and the applicant are going to know early on what the game plan is. And your remedy would be depending on what, if you went ahead and did the street, if in the construction process that was what was made sense to do the street widening, then if you prevailed, the local government would pay you the value of that improvement, basically. So the street would get widened, they'd pay you back. If in a certain circumstance it was in a separate phase of the subdivision, for example, and this appeal was resolved prior to the street having to be widened, then there would be no work done, nothing to undo. We tried to address that by saying that you could either, and it will depend on a case-by-case basis, either do the work, pay the money, post bond, so that if the condition is upheld on challenge, then whatever the subject of the condition is gone forward, whether it's a planting of trees or putting in a pond or paying money to the local government standards. Yes.
So, Mr. Chair, according to right now, then you can't move ahead at all if you're going to challenge one small part of a condition. You can't move ahead with the project at all. Is that the problem?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rose, yes. You get a conditional approval, essentially, that says you are approved. We believe this project meets our standards and what have you, subject to these conditions. And the subject to conditions, like any other contractual issue, if you don't agree with one of the conditions, it doesn't matter if it's a big one or a little one, there's still, you don't have an approval at that point. So, and that's the problem we're trying to address. One other point on page one before I move forward, I apologize for the level of detail here, but I want to make sure that the bill is clear. On lines 22 to 24, we're talking about the circuit court action. This is a part of the discussions we've had with local government. We've attached a 180-day time clock there, which is significantly shorter than the one which would normally apply to an action of this sort. It's our opinion that we would have, under normal circumstances, 6 years to file, because of the matter relating to real estate, and that's a statute of limitations in the state. So 180 days gives the local government notice far earlier that there's an inverse condemnation action going to be filed in circuit court, which will help them relieve some of the uncertainty that otherwise arises.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, that is a very short, I suppose you could call it statute of limitations, much, much shorter than present law. How did you arrive at 180 days? I'm just curious.
Representative Rubel, we were beaten into it.
Isn't part of this, though? I mean, these are going to be projects that are on a time frame. I mean, none of this is going to catch anybody by surprise 5.5 years later. Dave?
Representative Chair Shirley, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. The 180-day statute of limitations applies solely to claims arising from an exaction-type claim from a conditional approval. It wouldn't apply to your typical inverse condemnation action, but only to actions governed by this particular section.
So if a condition gives you heartburn, you're going to know that when you get the approval, probably.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Art?
Chair Shuttley, from our perspective, and I represent the Association of Oregon Counties, my name's Art Slack, we would like to see some finality, just as the development community likes to see some finality. And we have 120 or 150 days to make land use decisions. It seems to me that from the other side,
sauce for the goose,
that you ought to have a specified time in it. And since we've established those standards, we ought to be in the same neighborhood for challenge to conditions of approval.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to state for the record it's unfair to use our rhetoric against us.
Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
I'm moving to page two. Sub three. This gets at the issue of ripeness, sort of, in the sense that we wanted to make it clear that the local government would impose the condition, and that would be essentially their best shot at what they believe their code allowed or what they needed to approve the project, and that if we were to go challenge it, we wouldn't have to, as oftentimes happens in other sorts of cases, have to go back, be told by the court, so, well, you didn't ask for the variance, you didn't ask for conditional use, you didn't do a bunch of other things. In other words, whatever's on the table is on the table. And kind of as a trade-off for that, we agreed that all local appeals would have to be exhausted. And so whatever their local code provides for, we couldn't take a staff decision to impose a road widening and haul off to Luba with it. We would have to go through the city council or county commission. And there again, as was talked about on the earlier point, these are going to be things that are the subject of negotiation discussion. There won't be a whole lot of surprise that either I don't believe that the local government knows the developer isn't very happy with it, or the developer won't know what the local government's expecting. If I may, Mr. Chairman, before I go any further, I want to talk about the Dash 3 amendments, which aren't in front of you, but we had enough trouble getting the Dash 2s. We had a hallway conversation this morning with people at this table and came up with some other changes to the bill, and they will involve the substantial deletion of the rest of the Dash 2s. And so before I take the committee's time telling you what is on the page, we're going to get rid of. And what we're asking you today is to move the dash twos, and so to the extent that I need to do so, if you feel comfortable with it, I'll certainly explain what they do. But it's our intention and the agreement we have with this table is that the dash threes we prepared, and this bill, is, as the chairman said, is on loan from the General Government Committee, that when it comes up for a work session on Thursday in General Government, I'll tell you what the dash threes are going to do, and we will then have those in front of that committee.
Okay, go ahead and tell us.
And move the bill out. We're going to be proposing on lines 8, 9, and 10 on page 2. Jeff Condit, who used to be the city attorney for Lake Oswego, is now in private law practice, but is an expert on municipal legal issues, is working on some language to make it clear that on a constitutional challenge, if you're challenging a local government action under the Oregon or federal constitution, that the burden of defending that would lie with the local government, which is the state of the law right now under the U.S. Supreme Court's various cases, Nolan and Dolan and otherwise. So we want to make that clear that the burden is with the local government on a constitutional challenge. The rest of subsection 4 will be deleted. That's essentially an attempt, as the bill reads right now, to codify the Dolan versus City of Tigard case. That is the law of land. The concern was expressed, and we agreed to it, that anytime you try to codify U.S. Supreme Court holdings, if you get one or two words wrong, you can create an entire body of law that you did not intend. And while that makes more work for attorneys, that's probably not the way to do it.
May I ask a question?
You sure can.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, I'm looking at this and trying to visualize how this would happen in real life. Let me give you a for instance. I don't have before me section 2, chapter 215 or 227. And so would this apply to local county planning boards and that kind of thing? For example, a single-family dwelling neighborhood, somebody wants to build a duplex in the middle of it. It would apply to that, this whole procedure and process. And so basically, help me visualize. Somebody would accept a condition, let's say, You want to build a duplex in the neighborhood, and it's zoned single family, like as I said, and it's likely that the county might want to put some conditions on there that might make it kind of impossible to build a single family dwelling. So you don't, I mean, a duplex there. So you could go ahead under this scheme and build it. Is that right? How would it work under this? Take that fact pattern and run it through what you're trying to do here so I can understand.
Mr. Chairman, if I understood your question correctly,
I'm a little spooked here.
You get to rephrase it, then you can answer it.
Rephrase my question and answer it for me, John. Tell me what I'm thinking.
The answer is 42.
No, still no.
If what the local government has done is attach conditions that make it impossible to build the house, then no, you don't build the house because that makes that life too short anyway. But the way it would work typically is you go in for and it would apply to answer the first part of your question, it would apply to any land use action being taken. Issuance of a building permit is not a land use action, so if all you're doing is going in and pulling permits, this wouldn't apply. But if you're going in for any other land use action,
a variance, a subdivision,
a partition, anything of that sort. Any condition was attached to that. In your example, if it's not impossible, we are told to put in a row of trees to shield the duplex, the nasty duplex, from the nice single-family housing. And we don't
actually believe, this is a real case, and the duplex is a lot nicer.
Okay, then so we're shielding the nice duplex from the nasty single-family.
Yeah, you got it.
Condition to put a 52 Plymouth in the front yard or something, I don't know. Hey, 78 Duster. I'm flexible, Representative Willow.
Don't make comments about my tariffs, okay?
No, ma'am. I used to have one myself. So we are told to put in the trees. Uh-huh. We don't believe that we should be required to put in the trees. We scream at the local government, you can't do that. That's unconstitutional, illegal, immoral, and fattening. They say, too bad, do it. Under this bill, we would then go ahead with the project, put in the trees, in all likelihood, because that's part of the building process, that would make the most sense, and we would take the appeal of that condition, and if we prevailed, we would get paid back whatever it costs to put the trees in.
Or, I assume, would you also have the option of not putting the trees in, In which case, then, would you, if you needed to, would you bond it or something like
right.
that to, a letter of credit or something that to...
Mr. Chairman, that's right. We could go to the local government and say, we don't think you can. How about we put money over here to buy the trees if and when?
You're saying in that case it would make most sense to put them in just because it's part of the building process.
Yeah, in my hypothetical, yeah.
You wouldn't have to. You could always say, no, we'll bond it or something like that.
And the single-family houses are ugly, as he said, so we don't, you know, we want to cover them up quick as we can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So...
Okay.
Follow up.
Yeah.
So if I wanted just to give yurt on the back end of my property for a... it was an inside joke, sorry.
Yeah.
Never mind.
Yeah, inside baseball there.
Let me see.
Yeah, that's something we'll clear those up.
Guerbola, did you have your hand?
Yes, I was just going to make a comment. As slow as it seems, some building projects move along. If you left the trees to the left, the whole thing would be resolved to the court or Luber or something.
That's been known to happen, too.
Got that.
Let's see. I saw a hand up here.
Yeah, we're having a lot of fun playing what if here, but you did say something about paying, they pay you back. Now, what are you referring to there? If you move ahead and do this and abide by the condition and then challenge it and find out you didn't have to do that, are you saying then somebody would have to pay you back for doing that?
Mr. Chairman, well, let me give you a real-life example, which a developer was required to build a road as part of the subdivision approval. In this particular instance, because of the way the subdivision was phased in, he went ahead and he had enough money to built part of the road and squabbled with the county as it was going forward. And after a trip to Luba in the Court of Appeals, the county was told you could not require that. That was illegal. And he had already made substantial performance on putting the road in. And the county was required by the courts to pay him the value of the road. And based on his labor and time.
Well, Mr. Chair, is that part of this bill, or is that already current law, where the county would have to go ahead then and pay him?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wells, that's current law. If all this bill does is provide a mechanism to keep the project moving forward while an appeal is being taken, doesn't change the substantive appeal resolution of that appeal. Under current law, if an exaction is imposed that is illegal, that's kind of what the Dolan case was all about, Dolan versus City of Tigard, where they were told to put in the bike path and the dedicate property for flood control, and the court said you can't do that and made the city cough up, well, took a while, but they were required to pay the money back. And that's any time a government entity, whether it's city, county, or state, imposes a regulation or condition on any project, whether it's development or otherwise, that can't, is not legal, there's... You don't get to win and say that was illegal, but that's nice. Thanks for coming by anyway. I mean, it's you win the case, you get back whatever it was you put in. In some ways, I believe one of the things we've talked about with local government is that we're trying to make this, for all that I think it's safe to say, we at this table there's a disagreement about the number of times these sorts of conditions are imposed. We're trying to make it as easy as possible on both parties so that the local government doesn't get stuck without an improvement necessary to have the subdivision or the development application function well. At the same time, the developer is protected from having basically an unfair bit of leverage imposed. Yeah, the rest of the bill.
Follow-up question.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you. So if the I'm sorry, John.
No problem.
I was
you're
sojourning. Who knows where I was, but. So if the county says no way you can't have a duplex there, you can go ahead and you can't under this scheme go ahead and build it under those circumstances. So if there's a prohibition, this would not this would not open the door to
correct. This only applies to conditions of approval.
It only applies when the local government says you can do this subject to the following conditions.
So no more damning with faint praise.
Right. No, don't you understand?
Yeah.
Representative Orbelin, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question, John, on line 27, page 2, where it talks about the dedication of interest in real property. It talks about paying the fair market value. Can't you just give the property back?
Fair Representative Orbelin, yes, but before I go any further on that, section 5 is going to be deleted in the dash 3s.
I'm sorry, what?
Section 5 is going to be deleted by the dash threes.
You're just going under current law?
Yeah, whatever the remedies are.
Whatever the remedies are currently.
Yeah, right, right, constitutional.
So that would allow you to give it back?
In fact...
And Section 6 is out then, too, is that
section
right?
Section 6, with the exception of 6B, which is a mutual attorney's fees.
Wait a second.
Okay.
That will keep that part.
I'm looking at the dash twos.
Yes, ma'am.
Right, and we're taking something out of the dash twos also?
Yes.
Let me say again, they are working on dash three amendments that will be back. This is only on loan from general government, so we don't need to have all this nicely in front of us. After we get done here, we can vote to approve the bill as amended by the dash twos, as conceptually amended by the description given to us by the panel today, and it gives them the green light to go back to general government and finish up their work on the dash threes, and then general government will feel comfortable that it's had a going over up here.
And would you, thank you, John, go over those conceptual amendments
one more
slowly?
Time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Starting with, I guess, okay, so we know that 6B will be in a fashion. Oh, yeah.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Philip Fell from the League of Oregon Cities. Amazingly enough, I have to go see a man about a yurt, and I wanted to go ahead and get on record that the League is supportive of the proposed amendments, as John's talked. Okay. We all worked with him today, and I'm sure he will present them appropriately, and I know Marge down at the other end can reach him from there if he does.
That's right.
So, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And you promised that this disparate group of people are in agreement over this? I'm so excited.
Wait until you see me and Chip Lazenby and David Schumann up there together this afternoon at 3 o'clock.
Do I get to sit on that one, too?
You can sit in on that one. Okay. Finish. Give us then, I guess, the one more time on conceptual amendments, beginning on line 8 of page 2.
On line 8 of page 2, the concept is going to be that if it's a constitutional issue, if we're pursuing a constitutional claim under Section 5 of the Federal Constitution, or Article 5 of the Federal Constitution, or Fifth Amendment. Federal Constitution, Article 18 of the state.
Article 1, Section 18.
I'm tracked. Okay.
Then the local government will bear the burden of demonstrating their ordinances there, right, good, and trustworthy, which is...
Whatever the test is.
Yeah,
that's a constitutional standard.
That is a constitutional standard now, that the burden shifts to local government under a constitutional challenge. We are not going to be the balance of section from lines 11 through 16 of Section 4 will be gone. Rather than try to codify Dolan, we'll simply, whatever the law of the land is at that time, would apply. From line 17 through 30, Section 5 will be deleted in the dash threes. Much the same reason that we're not codifying Dolan, we felt that it was unwise to try to limit the remedies. So whatever remedies exist in law or equity will exist, okay, and we'll just use them. In Section 6, sub A will be deleted. Sub B will be retained.
Got it.
Part of the discussion we had with local government was to make sure that there would be an attorney's fees provision so that neither side would go into this willy-nilly. It's basically a loser pays.
Okay.
So that, and we changed, it's worth noting that we are modifying the normal LUBA attorney's fees provision. LUBA currently, under a regular land use appeal, has the ability to award attorney's fees, but under very constrained circumstances, only if the argument's been presented, basically if it's a dumb argument being presented with no real basis.
Non-meritorious,
then they can award attorney's fees, but they often do not. What this says is, if you go up under this provision and you're at LUBA, they shall award attorney's fees to the prevailing party, which again will help make sure that developers don't use this process just because they get bored. And I think we'll also assist local governments in that regard.
Sure.
Okay.
That's essentially the bill. It's a fairly simple concept that took 2 pages to write down. And we very much, I really want to express appreciation to the cities and counties, because this is going at the heart of what they do in the sense of approving a condition and development application. They've been very helpful and very patient and sympathetic with trying to address the problem, and I think understand that there is a problem that is worth addressing. And the measure in front of you, and they can certainly speak for themselves, but the measure in front of you with those conceptual amendments on the dash threes, I think meets with all their approvals.
I like it. Marge, you haven't said anything. Do you want to?
No, I haven't. Marge Kafori, representing the City of Portland. I just want to say it's been a joy and pleasure to work with these fine gentlemen to my left. We did take a bill that we were very concerned about, and through the amendments that Mr. Chandler has described, I think both meet the objectives that they had and satisfy the concerns that we had. So we are happy to go forward with it and to accept the dash threes in General Government Committee as they were conceptually described to you this afternoon.
All right, very good. I congratulate all of you and appreciate the good work.
May I ask one more question?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. I'll try to be succinct. I like what the work that you've done, and I congratulate you. Also in my files is a letter of concern from the League of Women Voters. Have you had contact with them?
That would have been a letter addressed to the original bill.
That addresses the original bill. I just wondered if they had concurred. Since you have this anomalous concurrence here, I thought you'd go for the whole thing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lowe, that would be anomalous.
I made you blush, John.
That would be, well, I'm trying to think of a polite way of saying something. I won't say it at all. That would be anomalous.
Well, you might even make it, though, with this last
rule. Yeah.
Well,
hope blooms.
Well, then, I think just to move this along. I'm sorry.
One more quick question.
Yeah.
About paying a fee. How would that work out? Would this acceptance of the condition, would you still have to go ahead and pay the fee, or could you get out of paying that fee until you had gone through these steps, or is this a way of delaying coming up with some cash?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wells, what we're trying to get at with the language on lines 12 through 15 of page 1, excuse me, is to say if the condition was the payment of a fee in lieu of a land set aside or whatever it might be, you would have the choice to, and it would be based on what you could work out with the local government, I suppose, or what their regulations required, of either paying the fee or posting a bond to make sure you had the money to pay the fee. The intent here, the intent of that language wasn't to be exclusive as far as what situation this might apply to, but to mention some examples of what it could be. So if my expectation in the real world would be if the condition was the payment of the fee be paid, because that's fairly easy to get back if and when prevails.
So, Mr. Chair, this whole process couldn't be used to delay paying a fee to conserve cash, capital, or this sort of thing?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Wells, what would happen, I presume, under this bill would be the local government would impose the condition, and you have the obligation, if you accept the condition, of complying with whatever it says, and the local government, in the condition of approval, would, if there's a payment of money, would have a time frame set forth, and you would have, as the applicant, you'd have to comply with that time frame. And whether or not you could bond around that would depend on what the local government code allowed. Some would let you, some would not. But you wouldn't be exempted from the condition because of this bill. If you had to pay the fee by a time certain and you did not, then your job would get red-tagged by the city or county for failure to comply. And they'd write you a stern note besides.
Okay. With that, then, the chair moves approval of House Bill 2474 as amended by the dash two amendments and as further amended by the conceptual amendments described today, and a referral of House Bill 2474 back to the General Government Committee.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, it's never left the General Government Committee.
Never left them. Well, anyway, we move approval of the bill for their edification. with the dash two as conceptual. Is there any objection to that?
Mr. Chair, I might ask a question. Yeah. Why is this happening? Because of their workload down there, or because they wanted good expertise?
They wanted good expertise, and of course, what happened was these guys all ended up working it out among themselves anyway. But it's been good.
Hey, take the credit.
You bet. Okay, yeah.
We brought them together.
They were afraid they weren't going to be able to pull it over on us, so it forced them to.
Exactly right, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Is there any objection to the motion? All right. Then this bill we are done with, but good work. Again, that's been a pleasure to hear about that, and it's an important bill.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, committee, we are adjourned until 3 o'clock.
We're adjourned until
3. At 3, we have...
You've got this on 25...